Race of My Life, presented by Autosport.
Night before the race, I just demanded they put a new engine in the darn thing. The first time I'd ever been forceful. When they took the old engine out, they found a bunch of broken valve springs. These are the words of 1961 Formula One world champion Phil Hill, describing the night before the 1961 Italian Grand Prix in an interview with Autosport magazine in 1988. This race, which Hill won for Ferrari to clinch the title but was overshadowed by the death of his teammate and title rival Wolfgang Von Trips, is the latest pick in our Race of My Life podcast series. I'm your host, Alex Kalanorkas, Autosport's Grand Prix editor, and with me again is Autosport's chief editor, Kevin Turner. How are you, Kev?
Very good, thank you. Yes, this is kind of an interesting one because some of the ones we've done before, I've already done my top 10 research, so I've been kind of armed with my alternative suggestions. But this one I hadn't, so I've done fresh research for this one.
In this episode, we're going to kind of be ever so slightly crossing over Race of My Lives with the Jack Brabham episode that we did recently, because there's several races in Phil Hill's career. Obviously, it's of the same era, it's the same time. And it follows on from that 1960 season where Ferrari was sort of, you know, coming to the end really with that engine program. The Cooper Climax was dominant. And then 1961, Ferrari turns up with the shark nose, with the new engine. And then it becomes the dominant form. So yeah, why don't you carry on my summary there of how 1961 had been going up until the Italian Grand Prix?
Sure. So much to the irritation and frustration of the British constructors, the F1 regulations were changed for 1961 from 2.5 litres to 1.5 litres. And most of them spent so long arguing about it that none of them are actually prepared with a sensible engine. Climax didn't have a V8 at that point. And Ferrari had... Ferrari had been developing what was a Formula 2 engine, which then obviously became Formula 1, the 1500cc engine. And so they were, even though they were not, I think, on a par in terms of chassis construction with Lotus and Cooper, they had such a power advantage. It depends what you look at and which of the two shark nose engines you're talking about. But it's something in the region of, say, 30 to 40 brake horsepower, which when you're talking about quite underpowered cars... was a significant percentage. So Ferrari completely dominated the 1961 World Championship season, except for two virtuoso performances from Stirling Moss, which obviously are very famous, the Monaco Grand Prix win and the German Grand Prix win. So it was always really going to be, the championship was always really going to be won by one of the Ferrari drivers, and the two lead protagonists were Phil Hill and Wolfgang Von Trips. And they arrived at Monza with Von Trips just sort of narrowly ahead in the championship fight.
To make matters slightly worse for Phil Hill, he had a pretty disrupted build-up to the race, gearbox problems in practice, and then a really unfortunate non-racing thing happened to his ear.
Yeah, it was a little bit reminiscent of the Jackie Stewart one, actually, that was also at Monza in 73 when he had health problems and car problems at the same time. So you think this is not going my way this weekend. Yeah, he went deaf in one of his ears. When he spoke to Autosport about it, he wasn't really sure then why it was. So he had to go off to somewhere in Milan and get that sorted out in a way that he found odd. But I think it worked. But yeah, so he had gearbox problems with the car, ear problems, and then he was also, as you started this piece with, he also had engine problems as well. He had no straight line speed, and this was the year that they had, this was last year that Formula One used the banked section at Monza, which was really, really fast, so top speed was important. Also very bumpy, which I think is one of the reasons why the British teams had boycotted it the year before, decided not to boycott it in 1961. I think history has lost why they were so furious the year before and less so the following year. He basically had pretty much all the problems going for him before the race even started.
I can say from personal experience of if it was the same problem I had that suddenly caused me to go temporarily deaf in one ear, it's really annoying. Like you can't do anything about it. It drove me mad when it happened. So, and I didn't have to go and get in a Formula One car in 1961 and drive on terrifying banking at Monza. So I can understand why he wanted to get that sorted.
Yes, yeah, and it's not ideal preparation, is it? Because anything that you want to be doing everything as much as possible in a racing car on automatic pilot, because you know, you're getting all the same inputs that you normally would, and you've got extra spare brain capacity to be thinking about, you know, positioning the car and strategy and all that sort of thing. So yeah, you'd want to get rid of that distraction sooner rather than later.
He does successfully do that ahead of the race, Phil Hill. Von Trips is on pole, but he makes a poor start, so Hill goes into the lead, but then it's on lap two where the incident happens with Von Trips and the whole event ultimately is terribly overshadowed.
Yeah, so yeah, you're right. So it's quite crucial that Von Trips isn't up at the front. So he's in the early stages, as often happened in pre-chicane Monza, you've got a slipstreaming fight. And it's probably even more crucial that year because the British cars needed to stay in the Ferrari's slipstream to stay with them, to stay in the tow. And yeah, Jim Clark's Lotus is one of those cars in the pack. And unfortunately, there's a bit of misunderstanding between him and Von Trips. And Von Trips' car is fired off into the sort of spectators, really, and he's thrown out and killed, and the spectators were as well. So yeah, horrible accident. Obviously now the race would just be cancelled and stopped immediately, but in those days they carried on.
Yeah, very sadly, 14 spectators also killed, and they say the race carries on. Hill wins. It's fairly dominant performance from him up at the front, but the other Ferraris do hit the same sort of engine trouble that he was suffering ahead of the race, right?
Yeah, so there's an incredible array of Ferraris. I mean, they were very to say committed to that race. I mean, obviously it's the home race, championship decider. So they were first, second, third, fourth, and sixth on the grid, which gives you a bit of five Ferraris. And Giancarlo Bighetti.
What they'd give to have that now, wouldn't they? Hey, that especially engine performance.
I was going to say one quick Ferrari would be handy at the moment. Never mind five, wouldn't it? But Giancarlo Bighetti and Ricardo Rodriguez, their cars break relatively early on, and leave Hill with his mate Richie Ginther out. Yeah, well ahead. The only car that got close to Ferraris really. Was Jack Brabham, who had the new V8 Climax. The Climax had finally got the V8 by then, but he broke quite early on. So it was just those two out front. And then Ginther had his own problems and Hill was left to kind of stroke it home. So the other four Ferraris all had problems, but he managed to bring his home. Not for the first time in his career. He showed that he had good mechanical sympathy.
It's interesting that though, because he says the point with the engine, well, actually, sorry, going even further, the point with the gearbox was that he has to really convince Ferrari that there's a problem. He has it takes a mechanic getting in and feeling the sensations for himself to make it realise that a change needs to be made. So why back then are they so reluctant to listen to the driver? Not listen to, but, you know, believe what's going on in certain situations.
I think this comes up, I don't think it's just back then, I think this comes up routinely throughout motorsport history, really, of some obviously it depends on the characters involved, both from the driver's point of view and the team point of view, but I think quite often engineers or mechanics think that the driver's just making an excuse, so they don't, you know, they don't want to put the extra work in to change something if they think that I was doing some research on the 1989 Hungarian Grand Prix, and in that Gerhard Berger asked Ferrari to change the gearbox during warm-up. And they after warm up, and they refused, and the gearbox broke in the race, and he was furious. So I think this has happened, and will probably continue to happen. It's probably less likely now because there's so much data available.
Yeah, that's
what I was thinking. They can probably see if there is an issue or not. It's probably much more transparent. But in those days, there had to be that much greater level of trust between the drivers and the mechanics. And I guess it would take an instance like that where the driver proves that they're correct for them to go. To believe you more next time, really.
And arguably in 2020, it's that combination of being able to understand the data and how that affects your feeling in the car that is really separating the really great drivers from the very good drivers. Like, for example, we know that that's what Lewis Hamilton is very good at, but he comes from an era where data originally wasn't quite so massively important. And then other drivers that had a similar sort of length career, for example, Felipe Massa, also a very fast driver, ended up not being quite as successful. But we're getting more wildly off topic here with the Phil Hill podcast. So let's, just at the end of the race, Phil Hill wins, but he doesn't know that Von Trips has been killed at this point. So again, it's sort of the whole, it's very muted celebrations and everything's overshadowed.
Yeah, it's kind of got echoes of the other American to win the Formula One World Championship, who also clinched it. Mario Andretti clinched his title at Monza, and the same day that his teammate Ronnie Peterson was killed. So sort of slightly spooky parallels, really. I was almost a little bit surprised that Phil Hill chose this as his race of my life. Because of that reason, you know, it must have been an awful day. I mean, he even says towards the end of the piece that it was really dreadful. And you kind of feel, obviously it's much worse for the people involved in the accident, but you know, this many years later, you kind of still feel sorry for Hill himself. Like his, what should have been his crowning glory, if you like, his greatest day, was so incredibly overshadowed by, you know, horrible events.
Indeed. And I mean, once the titles had been secured for Ferrari, they actually withdrew from the season finale in the USA at Watkins Glen, sort of citing the tragedy and the fact that obviously the titles already wrapped up. So why don't we end this section of the podcast? We'll just hear from Phil Hill again in his Race of My Life to Autosport. I went on and won the race, and all the other Ferraris went out with broken valve springs. Even though none broke before the race, the damage was done. We didn't know Von Trips was dead until after it was all over. For me, it was dreadful, quite dreadful. But I didn't want it to be dreadful. I didn't really know what was happening. I couldn't take it in. I'd won the race and the championship, but the accident took all the joy out of it. Well, yes, as you can hear there from Phil Hill's words to Autosport, not an overly happy memory, despite the fact he wins the title, understandably.
Several of the races that we're probably going to talk about seem to be tinged by tragedy. I mean, partly, obviously, that is the nature of the era, but also, it's kind of slightly odd how some of Phil Hill's best drives seem to come amid pretty awful things for other people.
Well, we've come to the part in the episode where we assess some potential alternative picks that the drivers could have had for their Race of My Life. With Phil Hill, as we were saying before, as we were getting prepared for this episode, Kev, not a huge amount in terms of the big headline results that he might have we would normally consider when it comes to alternatives. But actually, two that we're not even going to really chat about is the two actual F1 victories. First of all, the 1960 Italian Grand Prix, where he wins from pole for Ferrari. But as we've said earlier, no opposition really, because they were boycotting it.
Yeah, none of the British teams were there. They filled the grid out with F2 cars. Hill was on pole by 1.9 seconds from Ginther, and the fastest non-Ferrari was 7.9 seconds off his pole time. So, yeah, they disappeared down the road. One of the other Ferraris, William Arrest, was given the task of towing the F2 Ferrari of Wolfgang Von Trips to try and make it even more of a dominant result. So really, it was just Hill and Ginther. So yeah, not really the usual standard of a World Championship Grand Prix. Historically significant because it was the first, he became the first American to win a World Championship Grand Prix, and it was the last World Championship Grand Prix for a front-engine car. But as a race performance, I'm sure Phil had much harder days.
Absolutely. And what about the 1961 Belgian Grand Prix? Why aren't we including that? Because that is his first win in the 1961 season, but it's pretty much a Ferrari landslide again.
It is. It's a dominant performance. Spa. They just didn't have anyone. He had Von Trips. They kind of drove off together, and were pretty evenly matched. And no one else was really in the race. So again, it's hard to put that in a Race of My Life as a candidate for Race of My Life.
Absolutely. Well, why don't we get into the first real major pick we're going to talk about, which is a famous race in Formula One history, the 1958 Moroccan Grand Prix, famous, of course, for being the Stirling Moss and Mike Hawthorn title decider. So why might we consider this to be an alternative Race of My Life for Phil Hill?
Well, I think this gets a bit overlooked because, first of all, he's in his first season of F1 racing. So, to the performance he puts in, effectively, Stirling Moss for Van Wall, Mike Hawthorn for Ferrari, going at it for the championship, as you say. Moss had to win, set fastest lap, and rely on Hawthorn finishing third or lower. And Moss does his usual thing, but Hill goes off with him. Hill chases him and has a good old fight with Moss. And that would have been the first time, really, in a Grand Prix that I think that Phil Hill would have been challenging someone like Stirling Moss. In the end, he does make a mistake and go down the escape road, comes back in, recovers to second, and he's well ahead of both Hawthorn, his team leader, and Tony Brooks in the second Van Wall, who start a fight for third, which is quite crucial in the championship. He can't catch Moss, but he's well clear of everyone else. And then when Brooks's Van Wall breaks, that leaves Hawthorn in a clear third. And of course, then the inevitable call comes from Ferrari in the closing stages for them to swap positions. So Hill has done. It's the perfect team performance, if you like. Really, he's done apart from if he'd maybe been able to stay with Moss for longer. But I don't think anyone was going to beat Moss that day. It was you know, he was the quickest guy that season. If the van were held together, he normally won. So, yeah, pretty fine performance, and it helped Mike Cawthorn clinch the world championship.
Absolutely, and obviously that's the first British Formula One world champion in Mike Cawthorn. Well, we're going to go forward to the next season, the 1959 Italian Grand Prix at Monza, where Hill ends up finishing second for Ferrari. Another famous Moss win, this one. But why was Hill's performance particularly eye-catching?
Well, I think it's because he steps up again. I find Hill quite difficult to place in the kind of the pantheon of the greats, really, because I don't think he was quite on a par with the absolute top guys, you know, the Clarks, the Mosses, the Jack Brabhams during the era. But he was highly respected by his peers. And you know, he was a good solid performer. And then he had these days where, so in that race, you know, Tony Brooks was the Ferrari team leader, but the car basically broke on the line, and that left a three-way fight between Hill, Dan Gurney, who's also a relatively new Grand Prix driver at Ferrari, and Moss. And it's Hill again taking the fight to Moss until Ferrari have to make a tyre change, and they bring pretty much all their cars in within a handful of laps, and then realise that neither Moss nor Jack Brabham are actually going to stop for tyres, and Hill can never get back to Moss, but he does finish ahead of Jack Brabham. So again, it's probably one of his 1960 he became the sort of lead Ferrari driver, if you like, but 59 that was still Tony Brooks, so that's probably quite a significant drive to second place at Monza. But again, it's a power circuit where Ferrari was strong.
But then coming on to the next pick, or the next alternative pick, the 1960 Belgian Grand Prix at Spa. That's the year, that's why I'm saying this episode is going to cross over a little bit with the Brabham race in my life, because that's the year where it's getting really tricky for Ferrari, and sort of the engine on the engine front and the car's just not quite up to it either. So he does end up finishing fourth in this race, but he gives Brabham a good go of it in the early stages. But again, this is a race that's really overshadowed by other incidents. Moss is very badly injured in practice when his Lotus loses a wheel, and two other drivers killed in the race. So, you know, why? Let's concentrate on Hill's performance. Why was this one so noteworthy?
Well, I think even on the fast circuits, the mid-engine cars, the Coopers and Lotuses, were beginning to give the Ferraris trouble. And there was a big multi-car fight early on in the race, which Brabham breaks away from, and then Hill manages to, and he goes after Jack Brabham, giving him a race. And after Stirling Moss's accident in practice for that race, Brabham kind of has it his own way at several rounds that year. And Phil Hill is probably the closest guy to put in a fight. So as you say, Jack Brabham himself picked the 1960 French Grand Prix as his race in my life, because he beat Phil Hill on a power circuit. And if you like, this is the counterpoint that Hill was doing a good job. I don't think he would have beaten Brabham, but yeah, he was in that mix again. And he should really have been second, but he had to have a pit stop due to a fuel leak. The other reason I quite like this is that he was 3.3 seconds off pole in that race, and he shared the fastest lap with Brabham and Innes Ireland in the Lotus. And he was the one that went quicker in the race than he went in practice. And I always think that's quite a good sort of racer's thing to have. But in the end, as you say, he finished fourth, so he didn't get the result. But that was probably a better drive than either his win at Monza or in 1960, that is, or even his Belgian Grand Prix race the following season.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, but when one talks about Phil Hill, it's obviously not just Formula One success that he has. Three Le Mans victories. So, Kev, why don't you talk us through his success in the 24 hours?
Yeah, it's an interesting stat that he's kind of known, I think, as a bit of a Le Mans legend as well. Three wins, but they're the only three times he finished. Interestingly, he had 14 starts at Le Mans. He only finished three times, but each time he saw the checkered flag, he saw it first. So I was looking at the best performances, if you like, at Le Mans, and I'm tempted to go for the 1958 race. So it was 3 litre regulations, Aston Martin versus Ferrari, and it was one of those races where the weather descended, horrible conditions, and Hill was really impressive in those conditions, and him and Olivier Gondomier, he's co-driving all three of his Le Mans wins, They moved to the front quite early on Saturday evening. The Ferraris did seem to be better than the Astons in the wet, but the caveat to that is that Stirling Moss had already gone out in his Aston Martin, and I think that would have been a fairer reflection of how good the car was in the wet if Moss had still been around. But nevertheless, you know, Phil did the business. They had a challenge from the Duncan Hamilton Ivor Burb Jaguar as well until Hamilton went off, and they really just controlled the race. It was a proper fight with another works manufacturer and in really tricky conditions. So that one sort of stood out to me, whereas the other two races, the other two Le Mans wins tended to be kind of an intra-Ferrari battle, really. I think they had the quickest car in 1962. They had a special four-litre prototype. And the year before, I think that the heroic performance was probably put in by the Rodriguez brothers in a privateer Ferrari. So on that basis, I'd go for 1958 as probably his best Le Mans win. And the other race I wanted to pick out from Le Mans was the year that they didn't win in 59, when Moss famously went off early on in the Aston Martin to break the Ferrari challenge, which he did, except for that one car. The Hill Gondomar car stays in the race, leads after the Moss Aston retires. And as much as I'm an Aston Martin fan, and it's a famous day in their history, I don't think that they were going to, the two Astons, they were second and third at the time, I don't think they were going to catch Hill and Gondomar in the lead Ferrari. They'd done the sort of perfect job of staying out of trouble when everyone else had kind of gone a bit crazy, really. And they were in a good lead when the car started overheating. Ferrari rather euphemistically suggested there was a fuel system was the official reason, but contemporary reports suggest that there was quite a lot of water going into and out of the car as well. So I think the engine had cooked itself. But I think it's just a good example of Hill and Gondomar as a combination just being very good at, I think they were very good at pacing themselves across a race, 24-hour race, which is really what you had to do in those days.
Absolutely. I mean, it's interesting, all of these races that we're talking about is when Hill was with Ferrari. So where would you sort of rank him? Or not, maybe not rank him, where would you place him in sort of, I mean, it's difficult because Ferrari's had so many famous and incredible drivers over the years, but, you know, he did win a world championship in one of their cars, many Le Mans wins. How important is he to Ferrari's history? Maybe that's a better question.
It is a good question. I think there are key drivers that made a difference to Ferrari in terms of managing to rally them round and get them sort of more organised and be part of some. So I think John Surtees was the first who came along after Phil Hill. I think Niki Lauda was the obvious one in the 70s. And then, of course, the Michael Schumacher era, which until obviously the recent Mercedes domination with Lewis Hamilton was kind of almost the ultimate F1 team, really. Whereas Ferrari generally sort of treated his drivers as employees, and would often play them off against each other and all that sort of stuff. In terms of developing the car, I think Richie Ginther was quite important. He was known as a very good test driver. Phil Hill's significance there was that they've been friends from back in the day, and he helped bring Ginther over to Europe and get him a drive, although they did later fall out. In fact, one of the drivers I'd had to have on my list to mention was Phil's drive to second in the 1954 Carrera Panamericana in a privateer Ferrari, where Ginther was his co-driver, but in a co-driving a rallying sense, not in a kind of jumping in the car sense to drive it. And they only lost to Umberto Maglioli's 375 Plus, which was a more powerful Ferrari. And he was quite a road racing specialist. So I think that would have grabbed Ferrari's attention for both of them. So worth mentioning there. But yeah, I wouldn't say that Phil Hill's right up there as one of the best Ferrari drivers, but at a time when Ferrari was winning in Formula One and sports car drivers, he was a key part of the team at that time.
Indeed. Well, just before we wrap up this episode, are there any more races that you think worthy of inclusion?
I have one that's a non-Ferrari one, so that hopefully you'll like that.
Good timing,
Phil,
then.
Yeah, absolutely. So Phil Hill did go on to, I mean, obviously the whole Ferrari thing went rather badly after 1961. And he found himself in sports car racing. He went to the Ford program and did a lot of the hard work there on what became the GT40. Unfortunately, he was there when it was quick but unreliable, so he didn't really get much joy out of that. But he then was with Chaparral, which was a fascinating and innovative team that had all sorts of really clever ideas, one of which was wings. And they won the 1966 Nürburgring 1000 kilometres, but they're a little bit fortunate to win that one. Whereas the 1967 BOAC 500 at Brands Hatch where he shared with Mike Spence, probably the most famous Phil Hill win in Britain, and his last major international win, really. It was a big, big fight. It was a really impressive entry of cars. It was a Ferrari versus Porsche season finale, title deciding. Ferrari brought in Jackie Stewart to be paired with Chris Amon. That was how serious it was. And Mike Spence and Phil Hill beat all the Ferraris and all the Porsches with the high-winged Chaparral 2F. I probably wouldn't put it forward quite as Hill's number one, because Spence actually had got the lead with the car already when he handed it over to Hill. They did suffer a puncture, and the lead went backwards and forwards between them and the Amon Stewart Ferrari. But the Chaparral was, I think, just that little bit too good on that day, and they definitely deserved a win because they'd been quick all season. If you judge your races on who finished second, then finishing ahead of Chris Amon and Jackie Stewart has got to be worth a mention, surely.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, as we've come now to the point of the episode where I have to make a ridiculous pick on whether I agree with the race of my life of a world champion in this case, I am gonna stay with Hill's pick, I think, just because of the seriousness of the situation. It would just feel wrong to dismiss it, if that makes sense. Obviously, you know, he wins the race, he does everything he can, it's the crowning glory moment of his career, and I feel like that's why that sort of has extra significance. But even in 1988, you know, when he's talking to Autosport, you can tell how overshadowed it was by the tragedy, understandably, of course. And there must just be a really difficult moment for any champion to suddenly be like, I have achieved the ultimate. And you sort of, yeah, as you say, Kevin, you know, it doesn't compare to the people losing their lives and the real sadness there, but it's still, it's another dynamic to deal with. So for that reason, I think we'll stick with the 1961 Italian Grand Prix.
Yeah, I came to this kind of thinking that I would try and pick something else, just because it was such a dark weekend. I mean, it's still the worst disaster, and let's hope it forever will be the worst disaster in F1 history. It feels right to try and put something else in there, but the fact that he chose it himself, I think, yeah, you have to say if he could do that, that counts for something, as it always does with these. But also the amount of things that he had to put up with before that. You know, he's really had to overcome all those problems. I think it's very interesting and telling that he says in that quote you started with that it was the first time that he'd had to be forceful. You know, that's a driver kind of taking their opportunity and really going, no, this is important now. I need to make this happen. I'm going to make you do this. And ultimately, that's what means that he finishes the race. They put a longer ratio in as well. So, you know, it's that winning the race before the race has started type approach, despite all the problems. It's kind of reminiscent of Emerson Fittipaldi's Race of My Life as well, with the ridiculous Lotus Transporter crash and all the rest of it before he got to the start line. So, yeah, I think as much as I'm a sports car fan, and I'd quite like to go for the 1958 Le Mans, because I think that was pretty mega. And I think that Hill was probably a better sports car driver than he was a Formula One driver. I'm not going to argue too hard against Monza 61.
Kev, thank you very much for your time. Hope you've enjoyed listening to this episode. And yes, thank you to everyone. And we'll be back soon with another episode of the Race of My Life podcast.